But first, the acclaimed author George Saunders. He's one of the modern masters of the short story. George won the prestigious Man Booker Prize for his innovative novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. His latest book is called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. The book is based on a class about the Russian short story that he's been teaching his MFA students at Syracuse University for the past two decades. The book features eight stories by such 19th century Russian masters as Anton Chekhov and Leo Tolstoy, along with George's insightful essays about the stories. We zoomed in with George in his Upper New York home to find why these stories struck such a chord with him.
From my point of view, I just love them so much. And what I found over the years was if I was teaching something about which I felt enthusiasm, it always made for a better class. These stories, I think they're kind of, in a certain sense, they're simple. They're moral fables, really. They speak to the kind of questions that keep us up at night. You know, how should I live? Why is there death in the world? You know, what is love really? So they've appealed to me since I was very young. And I just noticed that when I teach this class, my own natural enthusiasm somehow animates the classroom. And we ended up getting into these, you know, semester after semester, these beautiful moments where the distinction between teacher and class goes away. And we're just a bunch of writers trying to figure out answers to these, you know, trying to figure out how these stories work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your book features essays that examine the physics of the short stories you've included. What exactly do you mean by the physics of the short story?
Yeah, well, you know, I came to writing from a kind of weird angle. I was an engineer, kind of from a broadly working class background. So for me, stories were always, you know, under the heading of entertainment. And I found over the years that the best way for me to think about it was just, where is my mind when I start the story? Well, essentially, it's empty. It has no concepts. Then you read even a paragraph and suddenly you're inflected a little bit. You've got some curiosity aroused. You've got some emotions aroused. So that's really the basis for how I write and read stories is let's just treat it as an experience that we go into that inflects us and does something to us. We can look at it kind of diagnostically and say, well, what did it do? Where did it do it? Was it positive or negative? And when I left the story, how was I changed relative to the guy who started it? You know, I'm a former engineer, and that way of thinking of stories really is easy for me and fun.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it's something that your students would enjoy because it's an interesting take, and it makes a lot of sense to analyze the story that way and figure it out in terms of physics.
Yeah, and also it kind of demystifies it. You know, I remember when I was a young writing student, I just felt like there must be some secret in a golden box somewhere that everybody was keeping from me. And it was really refreshing to go, no, actually, you know how to enjoy a story. You've been doing it since you were a little kid, you know. So what is criticism? Well, really, it's just having an experience, having a genuine, not feigned reaction to the experience, noticing that experience, sort of blessing it, and then trying to articulate it. That's it. And that goes for if we're going to the opera, or we're having a love affair, or we're traveling to Russia, or we're going to the moon. That's basically what human beings do. So my thought is we can kind of almost have a scale model of that process by reading a story, and we can actually get better at it, which means in the long run, we're developing more confidence in our own perceptions and in our ability to talk about our perceptions afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about Anton Chekhov's 1898 short story, Gooseberries. When did you discover this story?
I first heard it my first semester at Syracuse. I was just off the back of whatever truck they say you fall off of. I'd come from Amarillo, Texas, had never really met, famous writers. And Tobias Wolf, my teacher, had scheduled to do a reading at the Syracuse stage. On this snowy night, and he was a little under the weather, so he decided to read Chekhov instead of his own work. And he read this thing called The Little Trilogy, the middle story of which is Gooseberries. And it was just one of the most beautiful evenings performances I've ever heard. It was almost like Chekhov had materialized in the room. And Toby is a great reader, if you've heard him, and a great person. So it was just a moment when I went, oh yeah, this is what I'm going to be doing with the rest of my life, for sure. If I could do anything that even approximates the feeling that we had in that room, I would kill to do it. You know, let's get started.
Yeah. So walk us through Gooseberries. What happens in the story?
Well, basically, the way I teach it is, the story is these two guys are going hunting and it starts to rain and they go to a friend's house and one of the two hunters tells a story and the other guys are kind of bored by it. That's basically the big plot. Within that structure, what happens is his story is about a very kind of radical notion, which is that happiness is not actually good, that happiness is a form of decadence, that we, if I'm happy, it's because someone else somewhere, someone else has paid for it. You know, I'm oppressing them. It's a story about that, the way that we all feel when everything goes right and we do a little victory dance and then we feel kind of guilty about it. You know, that kind of almost sugar buzzy feeling that comes from happiness, especially in a culture like ours where so many have so much and so others have so little. So it's a very convincing argument about that. And if, you know, if you've never had that thought before, as I hadn't when I read it, it's kind of revelatory. You know, happiness is not necessarily something to go after. Instead, we should think about the happiness of other people. So that sits there in the story a bit. And then as you start to, well, at the end of the story, there's a moment where this guy who just made this beautiful speech does a kind of small but thoughtless thing. And in that instant, your mind instantaneously reconsiders the whole story. And you see that actually that guy has been happy several times in the story. He's maybe the happiest person in the story. So I'm not quite doing it justice, but basically the story is sort of a living, breathing thing that means by contradicting itself. And it leaves the reader at the end saying, wait a minute, is happiness good or not? And the story goes, I know, right? And then Chekhov leaves the stage. It's almost like the Wile E. Coyote when he goes off the cliff. You know, he stands there for just a second. He's flying, you know, and then he's not. So in the book, I make the case that that's one of the things these Russians do really beautifully is they just show us how habitually judgy we are and how really that position of strong judgment is often not supported by the world. And it actually makes us, I would say, morally smaller beings to always be trying to judge and reduce. And the story just leads us for a couple seconds into a higher realm, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. You say that a story means at the highest level, not by what it concludes, but by how it proceeds. Can you explain what you mean and how this applies to Chekhov's Gooseberries?
I mean, often, you know, and I think we're taught this in school, we come out of a work of art, a story, and we say, what's the takeaway? Or what's the theme? What's the writer trying to say? In Gooseberries, we see that Chekhov's mastery is that he's saying several things at once, and they're all true. That's really hard to do. You know, it shows a kind of really sophisticated and compassionate mind at work who says, he blurts out a certain truth, happiness is not to be trusted. And then he goes, on the other hand, and for me, you know, that's one of the holiest phrases I've ever heard. On the other hand, it stops us from settling into too neat judgments. It keeps us multiple in a certain way. So the story's form in a really beautiful, complicated way that even now I can't understand it, having studied it for 2 years. Every time it makes an assertion, it runs around to the other side of the table and gives us a counter assertion. And it absolutely refuses, like some kind of holy man, you know, never to pronounce. And then it shows us that, you know, we can exist in that state too, you know. So the story is not, at no point does it tell us what to think about happiness, but it's basically a way to think about happiness. And if a story is that good, we take it out into the rest of our lives. And every time I'm happy, I think about that story. You know, every time I get a nice, you know, writing accomplishment or something, or something goes right in my family life, I feel that little swell of happiness. And I remember that speech and I remember the counter speech. And it just, I think it just brings a person a little more alive, you know? You're just a little more there than you were had you not read the story, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You compare a short story to a mixing board in a recording studio, and I think that's a very clever analogy. Can you tell us about that?
In a story, there are literally thousands of indicators. It might be a physical description. It might be a recurrence of colors. It might be the way a character develops. Each one of those might be thought of as a fader switch in a recording studio. Once you've introduced a thing, you know, once you have a character named Jim, that's a switch. So having the right switches in the story is part of the mechanics. The other one is to adjust that switch so that it's giving off the maximum amount of light. So for example, let's say that Jim in the story, his main goal is he refuses to lend his mother some money. Let's say that's his reason for being in the story. Well, that's good. So that's a fader switch. Now, the question is, why does he do that? And depending on why he does it, it becomes a totally different story. If he's a stingy, grasping person like Scrooge, that's one. If he would love to lend his mom some money, but he doesn't have any because he's just been laid off. That's a different story. So the process then is to precisely set that switch so the story will give off the light you want it to give off. So that's it's an interesting, again, a technical way, but it's a handy metaphor to use in talking about stories. It's not literally true. And some people, if one of my students rejects that metaphor, I certainly allow them to, because all these ways of talking about writing are just to try to reach them, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to ask you about the physics of one of your own short stories, a story from your collection 10th of December called Styx. It's only 392 words long, yet it's so powerful. Can you tell us what the story is about and how you came up with the idea?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it so long ago. I was working as an engineer, and I had just one day I said, I'm going to try to write two stories today, two one-page stories. The other one was nothing. It was no good. But this one was, you know, we'd been going to church. Our kids were little. We'd been going to this Lutheran church. And every day when we, or every Sunday when we drove to church, there was a house that had a kind of a metal pole with a crossbar. And somebody in the house was taking the trouble to decorate it. Like they, in Halloween, they put it in a ghost costume. And when the Buffalo Bills were playing, they'd put a helmet on it. So I was going to write a story admiring that guy. And then often, you know, when you, a first idea about a story comes to you, if you just turn it around 180 degrees, it's better. So in this case, I said, okay, I'm thinking about the positive qualities of doing something like that. What about the negative? What might that tendency be hiding or cloaking? And so the story just came out literally in one sitting. I don't think I did much rewriting. And then I kind of put it aside. And only 15 years later, I put it into that book and people have responded to it. I'm not really sure why. It was just literally an impulse and then a blurt. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't happen too often, but it's always nice when it does.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never would have guessed to like, I've read, I think, all your short stories pretty much. And I never would have guessed that dated back to your engineering days. And I think one of the things that makes Styx work so well is that you used the first person plural, we, for the point of view. Why did you choose it?
It's interesting, you know, that the question of why a writer chooses. For me, I never have a good answer for that because it's the best decisions are just split second, almost like the way you catch a frisbee, you know, mm-hmm. Which hand are you going to use? You just do it. The less good decisions are the ones that I rationally arrive at, you know, the second person plural would be better. It's just a gut feeling. And one of the points of this Russian book that I kind of stumbled on is that I really believe in intuition as an underestimated human power. You know, we use it all the time. I think it's a conduit to a kind of deeper wisdom than the wisdom of rational thought. And art is one way that, you know, reminds us, especially as a practitioner, again and again, that there is something to this first thought, best thought idea. And there's not much to say about it, really, strangely. It's a very almost like a Zen positioning. But most of the good decisions I've made in stories are made just instantaneously, you know, without any rationalization.
There's a very distinctive internal voice in your fiction. How did you discover your internal voice?
You know, a lot of stuff in writing, it seems to me, is it falls into the realm of allowing yourself or enabling something, blessing something that you would do all the time. So since I was a little kid, I used to love Dick Cavett. And I was always talking to Dick Cavett in my head, you know, as a little kid. It's probably not an admission I should make, but you know, this idea of turning your mind on the mind, and like, what does my mind do most of the time? You know, I notice I'm always in conversation with somebody. If I'm trying to think of whether I should do something or not, there are several entities, let's say, and I'm not, you know, literal entities, but there's several positions within my mind that are going back and forth. So a lot of that internal monologue is just making a very poor attempt to mimic the actual monkey mind that I have, and recognizing that within a single first person or you know, internal voice, you can actually have a whole host of characters to make certain rhetorical arguments and so on. So really, and also it just was funny, you know, I think it's very funny when you have someone thinking about some grand thing that they're going to accomplish and then they fall down the stairs. That's, you know, the essence of comedy.
Yeah, comedy is a man or a woman in trouble, yeah. Has writing A Swim in the Pond in the Rain changed the way you approach your work?
Well, you know, it's a really smart question. I am having more fun writing than I've ever had, and I seem to be more productive than ever, and I don't really know why. I think just the discipline of looking at those stories technically has sort of done something. I don't know what. I didn't expect that, but I thought it might make it harder. I thought I might get self-conscious, but kind of the opposite has happened. I feel like, and I also feel so excited about the possibilities of the form now. I think before this book, I was kind of, you know, you get to a certain age, a certain point in your life, and you feel like, okay, I kind of know what I'm doing, and darn it, I know too well what I'm doing, and I'm cornered a little bit. And somehow writing this book has really just blasted that wall down, and I feel like my only regret is that I'm so old. You know, I wish I had another 200 years to work on the form, because it's really unlimited. There's so much that one can do with it, and so much I'd still like to do with it.
George Saunders, thank you very much.
Look, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
George Saunders is the author of A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a master class on writing, reading, and life. You can find out more about George at wpr.org/beta.
So Blockbuster's genius idea for their vending machines that had movies in them was to put them in the locations they already had, which is the parking lot of a Blockbuster Video.
Coming up, director Taylor Morden and writer Zeke Cam on how Blockbuster Video went from more than 9,000 stores across America to one remaining store in Bend, Oregon. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.